Tactopia. Tactopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, AM Hub, Index Award, Electronics of Tomorrow, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tactopia. Den her udgave af Tactopia, den starter i en lufthavn. Jeg sidder og kigger på to små piger, der leger med en grøn ballon. Vi sidder i afgangshallen i lufthavnen i Tel Aviv i Ben Gurion lufthavnen. Vi har været til Cyber Week på Tel Aviv Universitet. Og ved siden af mig sidder danske Lone Juul Dransfeldt Christensen. Og du har været til Cyber Week for anden gang. Og så er du sådan en, man kalder for en white hat hacker. Måske skulle lige forklare, hvad du laver først.
Nu arbejder jeg som sikkerhedsarkitekt, men har de sidste par år arbejdet med offensive security som konsulent. Som sikkerhedsarkitekt, så laver jeg nogle af de samme ting. Jeg gør det bare internt i virksomheden, så jeg står for at lave hackertest, penetrationstest af Bang & Olufsen, for at finde ud af, hvor er der nogle sårbarheder, som vi skal have kigget på.
Og du har så været til Cyber Week, ligesom jeg har, 4 dage på Universitetet i Tel Aviv. Kæmpestor konference, stor blanding af hacker og sikkerhedsfirmaer, men også regeringsrepræsentanter og folk fra NSA og FBI og alle mulige andre fra techbranchen. Sådan en virkelig en pærevælling, sågar den israelske premierminister har været der og holdt tale. Hvad er det for et sted, og hvorfor kommer man der?
Altså, jeg valgte at komme her første gang, fordi at jeg havde hørt om det økosystem, de har nede for cybersecurity, hvilket gør, at der er nogle eksperter hernede, som er rigtig gode. Og med økosystem, så mener jeg den måde, hvor at de får trænet folk gennem militæret, som gør, at folk kommer ud på arbejdsmarkedet med utrolig mange kompetencer inden for det her felt. Og derfor så er der mange, der starter virksomheder op selv, og der er mange af de store internationale virksomheder, som har deres research-afdelinger i Israel. Så der er rigtig mange inspirerende mennesker hernede, og det gør også, at når man holder et event som Cyber Week og som B-Sides Tel Aviv, som også er på samme tidspunkt, så tiltrækker det rigtig mange fra andre lande også, som gør det muligt for os at netværke og ligesom trække viden fra hinanden og lære hinanden bedre kende.
Nu nævner du det, der hedder B-Sides Tel Aviv. Jeg var førstegangs deltager hernede, så jeg har ikke lige lagt mærke til, at det var, ligesom, det var stedet, man skulle være. Så der var udsolgt, så jeg kunne først komme ind ret sent på dagen og se, hvad der var, I gik rundt og lavede derinde. Men hvad er B-Sides for noget? Det virkede som det, hvad skal man sige, det mest funky sted at være på den her konference.
Ja, altså B-Sides er et event, som er startet for 10 år siden i Las Vegas, som nu er internationalt. Og det skyldes egentlig, at DEFCON begyndte at blive så stor, at man manglede community-delen.
DEFCON, det er sådan en hackerkonference i Las Vegas.
Ja, præcis. Så det er den største hackerkonference, vi har, som bliver holdt en gang om året i Las Vegas. Så lavede man B-Sides, eller ved siden af, så det var egentlig konferencen ved siden af DEFCON, hvor det så handlede om community, lige netop, at man kunne komme tæt på hinanden, andre researchers kunne snakke sammen, og det ville være nemmere for folk at kunne komme ind og holde et oplæg første gang, arbejder meget med at hjælpe folk med at holde oplæg og lignende. Og det har så spredt sig til det, der hedder Security B-Sides, som nu er over hele verden, hvor man blandt andet har B-Sides Tel Aviv. Man har også mange B-Sides i Europa. Så det er et sted, hvor security researchers, hacker, de kommer og holder oplæg fra hinanden, så du ser de mere tekniske oplæg, hvor folk ligesom gennemgår nogle af de hacks, som de har lavet, og forklarer, hvordan fandt de frem til det, og hvad er det, de kan gøre. Og så er der et netværk-event, en afterparty efterfølgende, hvor man så kan snakke sammen og lade hinanden med at kende.
Men det er vel mere netværk, ikke? Nu ser du også, fordi de nu er derinde sammen med dig der sidst på dagen, og der bliver smidt en masse kode op på skærmen, og folk snakker for mig og ser ret indforstået.
Jamen, det gør de meget. Altså, der er en teknisk dybde. Der er lidt forskellige oplæg, kan man sige. Det første oplæg, der kom på, som var en af keynotesene, var Eva Galperin fra EFF, som egentlig fortalte om det, de undersøgelser, hun har lavet i forhold til stalkerware og hvilken betydning det har, hvordan man kan gøre noget ved det, som egentlig var meget high level, og så har du de folk, som har været ude og lavet noget security research, som kommer og går helt ned i dybden, hvor det er meget teknisk, kode linje for linje, sådan her gør vi. Så der er lidt af hvert på, på konferencen, også for at gøre det muligt for folk, som måske er nye til feltet, at komme ind i feltet. Og det er også for at styrke folk, som måske ikke har så meget erfaring, men gerne vil det her, for at komme ind og lære nogen, så de kan ligesom lære folk at kende miljøet og lære hinanden.
Men udover det med netværket, hvad tager du så med dig hjem? Fordi jeg tænker, der var jo altså den der blanding af cybersikkerhed og sådan lidt skæg og blå briller. Kan man bruge det til noget af det daglige, eller er det bare sådan en god underholdning?
Det er jo helt klart noget, man kan bruge i det daglige. Ofte så er det den der med, at når hverdagen kører på arbejdet, så går ting meget hurtigt. Så det der med lige at trække sig lidt væk. For eksempel, der var en snak omkring hacking af integrationen mellem Alexa og Cortana. Så hele den der med at tænke på at sige, nu integrerer vi to ting, som i det kontekst, hvor de var udviklet, måske på hver sin måde har tænkt sikkerhed ind. Men i det, man kobler dem sammen, så introducerer man nye sårbarheder, fordi lige pludselig blev Alexa brugt på en måde, som det ikke var meningen, at Alexa skulle blive brugt på. Og så laver man nogle, altså så kommer der nogle sårbarheder frem der. Så den der med lige at tænke, altså der kommer nogle nye vinkler på, se hvordan er det andre folk gør det, så når jeg sidder og hacker og laver nogle ting, jamen så gør jeg det på min måde. Så lige ved at steppe ud og så sige, hey, han tænkte faktisk den her vej rundt, eller der var lige nogle elementer her, eller så kan man lære ting.
Der kom en ballon.
Der kom en ballon flyvende. Ja. så på den måde, så giver det meget, og så er der meget snak omkring hele det der, responsible disclosure, som man har nævnt det før. Hvordan er det, når man finder noget, man snakker med de virksomheder, man finder det hos? Og der var for eksempel i samme talk meget omkring Microsoft, hvordan de så har rettet de her sårbarheder. Og de fleste af sårbarhederne rettede de egentlig ved at fjerne exposure af sårbarheden. Det vil sige, de rettede ikke root causen. Og derfor så blev den her sårbarhed ved med at dukke frem igen og igen. Og kunne egentlig blive indrapporteret flere gange. Så hele den der tanke med at sige, hvor vigtigt er det egentlig, at vi ikke bare sådan fjerner exposure, udstillingen af funktionalitet, men faktisk går ind og kigger på kernen af den sårbarhed, der er, og hvordan vi får det væk.
Der var noget, jeg tænkte over, når jeg sad og kiggede, for der var mange, der snakkede om safety versus security. Men når man oversætter det til dansk, så betyder det jo det samme. Altså betyder begge dele jo sikkerhed. Kan du forklare mig, hvad er forskellen på de to?
Jeg kan give et forsøg i hvert fald. Safety er mere... altså det er jo virkelig svært, når det er sikkerhed for dansk vække ord. Men safety er mere, altså hvor tryg føler jeg mig. Altså så man skaber... på den måde. Jeg tror, de forklarede det lidt på en af oplæggene med, for eksempel, hvis han havde hans datter kastet hende op i luften og greb hende igen. At hun, altså, hun følte sig tryg, og det også var en form for safety. De snakkede meget omkring for eksempel den fysiske sikkerhed, altså med at komme ind. Bremse på bilen, safety. Hvorimod sikkerhed måske så mere faktisk er den fysiske parameter på indbygning i forhold til, at du kan gå ind. Så der er de der forskellige, hvad er det, der ligesom skaber, altså gør dig safe, og hvad er det, der...
Jamen, det stod mig lige ved det. Jeg tror måske, du brugte det rigtige ord der, at du sagde tryghed før.
Ja.
Så måske er det i virkeligheden tryghed og sikkerhed.
Ja, det tror jeg godt, man kan sige sådan lidt groft.
Nå, men det, jeg så lagde mærke til også, der var flere, der satte op i sådan en trekant, sagde safety, security og privacy. At det var ligesom tre parametre, der hang sammen, som man gik meget op i.
Ja. Ja, enten det, eller så siger man balancen mellem security og privacy, hvilket er også noget af det, vi snakker meget om derhjemme, blandt andet med den nye Center for Cybersikkerheds lov. Og der var faktisk mange debatter relateret i forhold til det, hvor vi har fået at vide af vores tidligere minister, at det handlede om, at vi skulle stole på dem. Og det er jo det værste ord, man overhovedet taget nogensinde kan sige til folk i sikkerhed. Fordi at hvis de ikke har tænkt sig at bruge det, der var i loven, men at vi skulle stole på, at de holdt sig inden for nogle mindre barriere, så lav loven derefter. Fordi det lige netop ikke handler om tillid. Fordi det skaber ikke sikkerheden omkring. Så den der balance mellem sikkerhed og privacy, den er kæmpestor, både her, men også derhjemme.
En af dem, man kunne møde, det var den amerikanske sikkerhedsekspert Beau Woods, der har beskæftiget sig med IT-sikkerhed siden 2004. I dag der kigger han især på det, der hedder Internet of Things, altså hvor alle mulige ting bliver koblet på internettet og begynder at kommunikere sammen. Og det er særligt et bestemt hjørne af den teknologi, han har øje på, nemlig sundhedsteknologi. Det startede faktisk med, at Beau Woods han arbejdede på et hospital, hvor noget af deres udstyr fik virus, og det handlede faktisk om udstyr på operationsstuen, så det var temmelig kritisk. På den måde fik han øjnene op for, hvordan den branche fungerer, eller måske rettere sagt ikke fungerer. Så i dag handler meget af hans arbejde i organisationen I'm the Cavalry. Jeg er kavaleriet, altså dem, der kommer til hjælp. Det handler om, hvordan man kan få teknisk udstyr på hospitaler og i sundhedsbranchen til at fungere, uden at det kan blive hacket. Og hvis det bliver hacket, ja, hvad gør man så?
My name is Beau Woods. I'm with I Am The Cavalry. We're a global grassroots initiative from the security researcher community. It's a bunch of passionate volunteers, free time, spare time, hobbyists, who are looking at cybersecurity issues where bits and bytes meet flesh and blood. In other words, it's the human life and public safety consequences that we're most concerned about, rather than some of the privacy or intellectual property or financial crimes.
And when you say human resources or humans, what could that be, for instance?
Yeah, so like human life or public safety issues could be medical devices, it could be cars, airplanes, trains, anywhere where you have this convergence of traditional legacy operational technology with information technology that comes together. And so it could be a connected power grid, for instance, or it could be shipping and logistics, some of the supply chain issues, like with Maersk or the DHL subsidiary. Those two were hit hard by a piece of ransomware called NotPetya, which caused, in some cases, delays getting medications to people, or in more extreme cases, like WannaCry, the ransomware that took down something like 40% of the UK hospitals.
You used that as an example this morning in your talk, and you also mentioned that it has never been assessed whether it cost, whether there was a cost of human lives.
Yeah, you know, we often hear that, you know, hacking has never killed anyone or no one's died through hacking. But the more that we try and look into the root cause of some of those beliefs, the more we find that we just don't have the data to be able to say. What we do have the data to be able to say is that a 4.4-minute delay in getting patients to medical care causes a statistically significant rise in mortality rate over 30, 60, 90-day time periods. And that was a study, I believe, out of the Journal of American Medical Association, looking at marathon routes and how ambulances have to go around the marathons to get stroke victims or heart attack victims to care. If you want to look at the UK National Health Service case, some of those hospitals were down for a day to a week. So where we know that a small delay increases mortality rate, obviously a large delay we would expect to also increase mortality rate, probably even more.
You had an example this morning of how you actually got into this, your first assignment on
sure.
at a hospital.
Yeah, so it was early on in my career, and I was working at a hospital, and it was like my first week there, and we got a call from the natal intensive care unit where some of the most vulnerable patients in the hospital are, so the premature babies. And they said that their fetal heart monitors were down and that they suspected it was a virus or a piece of malicious software. So I called the manufacturer, talked with them and gave them the information. They said, oh, we're sorry, we can't fix it. If we do anything to those devices, it has to be recertified through the FDA, which is not the case. So I said, okay, well, can you give me the credentials to log in? I can fix it. I know how to get rid of this malicious software. Said, oh, no, we can't do that. That would void your warranty. And so working with the hospital, my boss at the time, we drafted up a short memo to the CEO, said, we have this problem. We want to take this approach. Here are the potential upsides and downsides. The CEO signed off on it. So I used some commonly available hacking tools, something called the Metasploit framework, which allows defenders to test their own defenses. And I was able to get into the medical devices the same way the malicious software did, get rid of the virus, install the patch, and then the computers came back on and kept running. The medical devices stayed up for longer.
What you're describing here, is that becoming a sort of a more normal problem, something that we will experience more?
Yeah, I mean, the more we inject computers and computing technology and network connections into the world around us, the more that we'll have failures that resemble computer failures. So when your car has 30 to 100 computers in it, if any one of those crashes, it can potentially cause safety impacts. So the problems that we find in computers and that we've been dealing with as security professionals for many years are kind of coming home now. So they're starting to become more common, and the things that we own, like cars, our home internet connected devices, IoT, Alexa devices, or things like that.
But I understand in the case of cars that it can be dangerous, but what about Alexas? I mean, that's not really dangerous to us.
Yeah. Yeah, Alexas, there's a whole nother level of potential issues when you go to cars from something like an Alexa or, any other home connected device. But there can still be issues. So if you have a smart TV, for instance, that's able to monitor for sound, has maybe a microphone so you can give it voice commands, that could be listened in, that could be spied upon. If you look at some of the other internet-connected technologies, there are some cases where by giving too much information, someone can track you, and especially in the case of like domestic violence and domestic abuse, when there's an abusive partner that maybe has been kicked out of the house, or maybe the abused partner leaves and goes somewhere else, the privacy implications there can be catastrophic. And I've heard of cases where an abusive spouse has actually come home and used either the tracking mechanism or some of the voice recordings to find their victim and chase them down and do harm.
If you're just sort of a regular citizen and a user of technology like I am, for instance, I mean, what can I do to counter these problems?
Yeah, it's buyers and consumers and the owners are really in a position where they don't have a whole lot of degrees of freedom and things that they can do, right? But there are some emerging capabilities that are coming along, like the UK has a code of practice for IoT, and they've got a labeling strategy that's coming out alongside that. So you'll soon be able to look on an IoT device for consumer-grade IoT and see a couple of labels that will tell you whether they've got the security basics covered and for how long the devices will be supported with security updates and that sort of thing. So that's one thing you can do, is look for those types of labels. You can ask when you're buying the device at the store, if you're buying it at a store rather than online. You can also just make sure that you know how to update devices. Sometimes something as simple as regularly going in every 6 months or 3 months and making sure that you're on the latest version of software in the devices, that can help. When you start looking at medical devices and cars and other things, I'd say in those two cases, you should have some help from the dealer, the point of sale of the car, and from your doctor in the case of a medical device. So especially for medical devices, sometimes a vulnerable device can save lives, where not using the vulnerable device leads to more harm. So the best care delivery is when the patient and the doctor confer and understand the risks, understand the benefits, understand the costs, and then make a decision based on that.
If you look back in time, you could fix your own car. You can't really do that anymore because a car has become a computer and you don't have any control over it.
Yeah.
So how's that sort of going to develop in the future with connected cars and self-driving cars?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a lot of people who are tinkerers, they're hobbyists. You know, it's not just repairing. They also want to, you know, increase the fuel compression ratios and get a little bit more performance out of them, or, you know, do some other things maybe to make them more efficient. And by and large, we're seeing a lot of those capabilities going away, right? Unless you have sophisticated diagnostic software, it's really hard to know what's going on with your car when it's broken. In a lot of cases, that diagnostic software and the codes for the diagnostic software are not available to you and me. You'd have to license it, and only dealers can license it. So I think we're losing something in having so much complexity in cars. But then again, we're also gaining something in cars being safer than ever before today. There is a movement called the Right to Repair movement, where people are saying, well, look, we shouldn't have to go to a dealership to get our car fixed or to change the oil. I can change the oil myself. Or I can have, you know, someone do it who's an automotive professional but doesn't work for a dealership. And so their contention is that when you've bought something, you should own it and be able to do what you want with it, to be able to, you know, within the bounds of reason, right? So they want to be able to just do the simple things, right? And so that's a big movement in the United States that's kind of coming to a head. There's a lot of cases where people are figuring out how to reverse engineer the software, reverse engineer the codes, and to be able to run the diagnostics themselves to find out whether the engine light is something catastrophic or whether it's just, you know, change the oil or whatever the case may be.
Also, you had a look into the future this morning, 2025. Well, it springs to mind when you talk about fixing things and maybe getting your car to run a little faster. You mentioned, for instance, a deep brain stimulation, which if you could hack it to be sort of more like taking a drug. Is that a future do you really believe in? Or?
Well, that's a present that exists. So there are trials of deep brain stimulation going on right now. And in some of the trials, what I've heard anecdotally from some of the doctors is that some of the patients are actually tweaking the devices to get them high, to stimulate something different or different cycles, to stimulate pleasure centers so that they can basically get high. It's like taking a drug. So the famous sci-fi author William Gibson has said that the future is here, it's just not very evenly distributed. And I think this is a case where if we look and see what's going on today, we'll see the forerunners of tomorrow's problems, and we can look at those as not outliers, but what will become our life and the things that we'll have to look out for in the future. We can start getting ahead of those now.
And then you had some more examples?
Yeah. In one example I mentioned this morning, there's an actress who has a prosthetic limb, and she has the question of, can I repair my limb if it gets damaged, or do I have to have the company repair it? Can I tune it, tweak it, improve it like I would my natural muscles, you know, by going to the gym? Can I tune it, tweak it, and improve it, or is that a violation of some law or some license agreement? And so there's like those types of questions that are really interesting, and they might be, you know, extreme outliers today, but they'll be more and more mainstream the more connected we become. There's a law professor named Andrea Matwishan, and she's written on something she calls the Internet of Bodies, looking at future legal, cultural, social, ethical issues with the convergence of humans and technology.
So it's sort of like, what are the legal framework around cyborgs?
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Is what will the legal framework be around cyborgs? What are going to be the ethical considerations we have to have? How will things change when we radically alter what it means to be human?
Or enhance what it means to be human?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, if you can dream it, it can be done in science on a long enough timeline. Will we get our will we get our thinking ahead of the technology, or will the technology be too far ahead of the thinking? And what will the societal impact be of either of those situations?
Well, since you have worked both in healthcare, I mean, sort of within the system, and now you're you have this private initiative. There was another speaker this morning who said that 71% of the Windows computers on the hospitals in England they weren't updated, and they weren't actually able to update them anymore because Windows wouldn't support them, Microsoft wouldn't support them. So is this also a question about sort of the system or the administration not being able to understand what the problem actually is or will be?
Yeah, it's a really complex question, right? So there's a relay race with medical devices and with other hospital equipment to try and hand off updates from one party to another, right? So you have the whoever writes the software creates the vulnerability inadvertently, usually. They then pass it on to up the chain to someone who may be pulling in that piece of software into a medical device where the software was never intended to run in a medical device. So there's an assembler there. Then they pass it off to maybe a medical device maker to be a part of their bigger overall system or some kind of a systems integrator to integrate with medical devices and healthcare systems. Then you have the hospital where the device or the system lives. And so when there's an update, it has to go through all of those hands, all of the QA, quality assurance testing, all of the rigor that would go into it, which can cause quite a bit of delay. We already see that in things like the Android ecosystem, where when Google issues a patch, it goes out to the handset manufacturers who then have to include that patch in their platform, then goes to the carriers who then have to include the updates in their platform. So it can be quite a long distance. It can be a long race. If you look at where the issues typically break down today, we typically tend to focus on medical device makers and on hospitals. And that's where most of the control needs to be placed. We've found, though, that even with some of the best medical device makers, organizations like Philips or BD or some of these others who are far out ahead in terms of security, they can put the best systems in place, the best updates out there, but they're rarely uptaken by the hospitals themselves. If you compound that with the long life cycles in healthcare, which can be 5, 10, 20, 25 years, we're going to be dealing with legacy devices for a long, long time. So it matters less, I think, today what's unsupported and unpatched. It matters about how we deal with this long tail of support lifetimes for medical devices. There are some things that can be done, right? So a properly locked down and hardened system is way better, more resilient, more survivable than much more open system will be. So there are things that manufacturers can do at manufacturing time that even if the hospitals never install an update, the device can be more secure relatively rather than less secure.
So what you're saying is you should keep it offline, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough trade-off, right? So if you take the device offline, you break the connection, you break the scalability and the speed with which an adversary or an accident can potentially cause harm. But you also lose a lot of the benefit, right? And in the United States, we decided to plug everything in, right? We took a bunch of devices that were always threat modeled and built to not be plugged in, and then we connected them all to the internet so that we could look at population health issues. So can we study prevalence of smoking among teenagers? Can we look at long-term how patients act and react in response to a disease or a type of therapy? And those are all really, really beneficial goals. And it's suspected, I think, when they put that in place, they suspected it was going to solve tens of thousands of cases a year and prevent tens of thousands of negative impacts a year. But we've set ourselves up where we've consolidated the risk in such a way that any system connected to the overall network that has a vulnerability can potentially be impacted to cause more harm than if it were isolated. So it's a trade-off, and we just have to be knowledgeable, aware, and deliberate of those trade-offs and make sure that we don't inadvertently do something that leads to greater disease. One of my friends, Christian Demeff, says, as physicians look to treat existing pathologies, we should take care not to inadvertently create new ones. There's potentially some resources available to help. The one that we created from Eye on the Cavalry is called the Hippocratic Oath for Connected Medical Devices. The idea being that doctors take a symbolic oath to act in the best interest of patients. Increasingly, medical devices are the instruments of that care delivery, so they should also be designed, built, implemented, used, maintained with that same symbolic spirit. So there's five fairly easy to parse characteristics that you can go out and read it yourself. And it's a fairly short read with some more technical detail underneath that. I'm very happy to see that the FDA and a lot of medical device makers have actually picked up some of those concepts, as well as many more, and are starting to build them into devices now. And the FDA has actually made that part of the requirements to get on the market, is to be able to show, you know, that you're patchable, that you can take updates, that you have some level of forensically sound evidence capture, so that when something happens, you can trace the fault back and see, you know, was it an accident? Was it an adversary? Was it machine caused? Was it human caused? So I think there's a lot of good coming. I just worry that it might not come fast enough, and that it might not scale to the point we need it to by the time our really, truly bad adversaries figure out what they can do to us.
That doesn't seem very calming.
One of the things that we say is we want to raise the alarm without being alarmist. So there are potentially some very negative outcomes that can come. On the other hand, we don't want to scare people into turning away from healthcare. So connected technology is still the best treatment that we have. The advancements that we've made in the past 10 and 20 years because of connected technologies are amazing. And the ones that will come in the next 10 or 20 years are going to be even better. So we want to realize the promise of those without inadvertently causing some of the peril. I think the way I put it today in my talk is that I believe the biggest risk to the health of future generations is trust and trustworthiness in care delivery, connected care delivery specifically. Because if people don't trust it, they're not going to use it. And if they're not going to use it, then we're denying ourselves the best capabilities that mankind has to offer.
Det her, det er vel i virkeligheden lidt din Roskilde-festival, kan man sige. Så hvis du har været til Roskilde, så vil man spørge, hvad var det fedeste navn, du havde hørt. Men hvad er det bedste, du har oplevet her?
Jeg vil sige, helt klart noget af det bedste, jeg har oplevet her, det er de mennesker, jeg har mødt. Når man først starter ud, så for mig i hvert fald kan det være svært at skabe sig et netværk. Og jeg var rigtig, rigtig heldig, at jeg mødte nogle folk sidste år, som har været super gode til at introducere mig til folk i år. Og møde altså, virkelig mennesker, man bliver inspireret af. Folk, som har talt flere gange på DEFCON, som er den største konference, vi har. Det er bare inspirerende og giver en lyst til at ville mere. Og at de er så åbne og nemme at kommunikere med, og man ligesom føler, at man får bygget noget, som man kan bruge senere hen også. Det er helt klart allerbedste. Jeg tager med herfra. Det.
Så støtter vi også ind i en anden til en konference en aften om kvantecomputere. Det er jo sådan en lidt en fremtidsteknologi. Altså der er lidt derude, ikke, men ikke rigtigt. Hvad får du ud af sådan noget?
Jo, men altså det handler jo meget om at sige, hvad er det, vi er op imod? Hvordan er det, ser ud nu med krypteringen? Noget af det, man får ud af det, det er den der tanke med at sige, jamen hvis vi kigger på alle vores systemer nu, og jeg, når jeg kommer hjem, skal planlægge, hvor lang tid vil det tage at opdatere alle vores krypteringsalgoritmer, som vi har. Hvor lang tid vil det tage mig at gøre? Og så ligesom kigge på at sige, jamen, hvor lang tid tror jeg, der er, før at kvantecomputeren kommer. Og så kan man faktisk gå ind og regne på at sige, hvor lang tid vil det tage mig, men også hvor lang tid den data, jeg har, hvor lang tid tilbage er den vigtig. Fordi at når kvantecomputeren kommer, så hvis den data er blevet gemt et sted, så vil det kunne bryde den kryptering, vi har i dag. Så hvis jeg nu gerne vil have, at mine data er hemmelige i 5 år, og det tager mig 2 år at skifte det hele ud, men jeg tror, at kvantecomputeren er klar. Hvis jeg tror, den er klar om 10 år, så er jeg så på den gode side. Så ved jeg, så har jeg 3 års slack i forhold til, hvornår vi skal gå i gang. Men tænker jeg, at kvantecomputeren er klar allerede om 6 år, jamen så er jeg jo faktisk for sent på den. Fordi jeg vil gerne have, at mine data er hemmeligholdt i 5 år, og jeg vil gerne have, at eller det vil tage mig 2 år. Undskyld. 2 år og skifte. Så det der med at tænke fremad, det synes jeg er meget spændende.
Så simpelthen holde øje med, hvilke teknologier kommer der på markedet, som måske inden for en vis overrække kan forandre alt, hvad du går rundt og laver.
Præcis. Helt præcis. Så det der, altså ja, de nye teknologier, som kan ændre det grundlag, vi står på. Lidt på samme måde, som man går ind og siger, jamen, ved at vi nu begynder at flytte ud på del infrastruktur, som man gør, hvis man er i en global cloud, jamen, så skal man tænke på tingene på en helt anden måde. Der må man sige, at vi er kommet lidt bagefter for manges vedkommende. Der er mange, der er gået ud i skyen, uden at have tænkt over, hvad er det, det betyder, hvad er det, vi skal gøre i stedet for. Det kunne jo for eksempel være rart, hvis homomorphic encryption var blevet opfundet før. Det har man ikke opfundet endnu. Det er encryption af data i brug. Det vil sige, at dataen er krypteret, mens man behandler den. Det vil sige, at den, der er databehandler, vil ikke kunne se dataen, men vil kunne operere på dataen og sætte den tilbage, og så skal det så give det rigtige resultat. Man er kommet noget af vejen, men der er stadigvæk lang visesvej igen. Men det er jo noget af det, som også er super spændende, fordi det gør en forskel i forhold til at dele infrastruktur. Men udover det, så når man arbejder med homomorphic encryption, så selv hvis det lykkes, så skal man jo også sørge for, at det lykkes på en måde, så det er resilient overfor kvantecomputeren. Så alle de her elementer i forhold til, hvad der ligger fremadrettet, synes jeg er super spændende.
Den bog, du sidder og læser i lufthavnen her til sidst, den kunne da godt blive nysgerrig på. Hvad?
Det er en bog, der hedder The Code Book, The Science of Secrecy from Ancient Egypt to Quantum Cryptographics. Så det handler jo lige netop om nogle af de ting, som vi har snakket om i dag. Det er Simon Sinek, som skriver bøger inden for den her verden, og super spændende fortæller egentlig de historier om, hvordan kryptografi i sin tid startede, hvordan man skjulte beskeder til at starte med. Og så skulle den gerne bevæge mig helt frem til quantum kryptografi også i slutningen.
Så det handler om sådan noget som, hvordan man, for eksempel i Romerriget, det kan også se, der står det gamle Egypten, men hvis man for eksempel var i krig, hvordan man krypterede sin meddelelse, så fjenden ikke kunne opsnappe dem osv., hvis man sendte dem en kurier. Der er gang i bamserne og ballongerne, men ja.
Ja, men præcis. Så det starter egentlig ud med, hvordan man i starten brugte mange teknikker på egentlig bare at skjule beskederne, men ikke kryptere dem. Men at man egentlig bare for eksempel fjernede noget voks fra et bord, skrev ting ind i, og så puttede det ovenpå igen, så man så, når den kom frem, så kunne man sende det som et bord, og så kunne det komme forbi. Men i starten var man ikke beskyttet mod hvis de fandt beskeden, så var beskeden ikke beskyttet, for den stod i klar tekst. Det man gjorde også, som jeg synes er ret fascinerende, fordi det, dengang havde man lidt andet perspektiv i forhold til tid. Men der var også nogen, hvor de barberede alt håret af, så skrev de beskeden på hovedet, ventede på, at håret voksede ud, og så kunne den her person så rejse med beskeden. Og så krævede det jo så, at man gik så langt, når man undersøgte den her person, at man barberede dem skaldet, for at man kunne se beskeden. Så det er meget interessant i forhold til, hvordan vi arbejder med tid i dag, synes jeg.
Det er også en måde at gemme passwords på, måske.
Ja, præcis.
Godt. Lone, tak fordi du lige gad at tage tid til at fortælle lidt om Cyberweek og B-Size Tel Aviv her på falderæbet i lufthavnen, hvor du er på vej hjem. Så vil jeg overlade dig til din bog. Og sige, at det her det var Techtopia, der har været til Cyberweek i Tel Aviv. Du kan følge med i diskussionen på Techtopia Backstage, som er en Facebook-gruppe. Du kan skrive til mig på henriktechtopia.dk. Du kan finde tidligere afsnit og abonnere på vores nyhedsbrev på techtopia.dk. Og så kan du også følge med på Twitter, @techtopia.dk. Og så er der vel ikke andet at sige end på genhør, og må din kryptering være med dig. Techtopia. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, AM Hub, Index Award, Electronics of Tomorrow, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Techtopia.